We're going to start today with a conversation with David Blumberg, whom I met, I can't even remember, it must have been 15 years back, David. He's the founder and managing partner of Bloomberg Capital and has been in the venture capital business in the Valley for a long time. So we're going to have a chat with him. David, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor, and I'm humbled because I love your mantra, 1 million by 1 million. It's fantastic. We need more Ramanas.
It's a very difficult project, I can tell you that. So I want to start with your read of how the venture capital industry that we've been swimming in for so many years, how has it evolved in Silicon Valley over the last 6 years in particular, this decade?
Sure. If I may, I'm a history buff, so I'd like to take us back a little bit longer to the during dawn of the millennium, so from 2000 on. And the reason I do that is I think that historical context is extremely important for the entrepreneur, especially young entrepreneur who hasn't been through multiple cycles like we have. So the first thing I would say is that the 2000 dawned with an incredible bubble in technology. There was the dot-com boom, and we had probably too much money chasing a hype cycle, overinflated expectations, incomplete and naive business model, where people were chasing what they call eyeballs. They were trying to get lots of users, because the theory in those days was just get big fast. And if you were the leader in numbers of users, somehow you would magically find a way to monetize and then attain a dominant share and establish a sustainable advantage. That was not true. It turned out that one actually needed to deliver real value and start to monetize so that you don't run out of money along the way of the growth path as an entrepreneur. The tech crash caused a lot of dashed expectations, but it brought in much better realism to the entrepreneurial community, an understanding that yes, growth and profitability are necessary, and understanding, I think, on the funding community that a great team is just as important for managing as great technology or a great idea. And that execution is often the dividing line between success and failure. So with those bases, then let's also talk about what's happened in the entrepreneurial, in the technological realm since 2000. Enormously good news for entrepreneurs like you're talking to, and we're talking to today. The great news is that platforms and infrastructure have developed immensely to the benefit of consumers, to the benefit of young entrepreneurs, to the benefit of the people. The 1%, 99% divide is being rectified, not necessarily by governments, in my opinion, it's being rectified by technology and entrepreneurs doing basic things every day, like building the internet, building social media platforms, developing mobile phone technology, Internet of Things technology. All of this is benefiting average people that you probably know and I know that live in very destitute circumstances that are now able to connect to things like Wikipedia, which didn't exist 15 years ago. Remember, mobile phones are about 10 years old in terms of smartphones, so all this is new. It really has made the life of me, a venture capitalist who invests in early stage entrepreneurs, easier, because it makes the life of my entrepreneurs easier. They can now start companies with much smaller amounts of capital. The cloud infrastructure makes it possible for them to start a company without owning what we used to call a PBX for telephone central switching or mainframe computer or a database. All of that is now available in the cloud. And I don't mean to be patronizing, a lot of your audience knows this already, but just from 15 years ago, 2001 to today, all of that changed to the benefit of the future world. Now, in the last few years, if it's okay to continue, there has been a bit of another hype and a deflation. And we can talk about that more later. I think you have some questions on it. But I think that the main point is that, again, opportunities for entrepreneurs are still very strong. Look at the development of the developing countries. With just mobile phones and social networks, we can now have reach two ways. It's not just anymore a colonial export model. It's a two-way street. We can buy and sell data, we can buy and sell software, we can develop things in rural India and sell them to Silicon Valley and vice versa. We have companies in our portfolio that are 8 years old and they sell in 200 countries. That's astonishing to me. I'll pause there and let you ask some more questions. Yeah.
Well, I think you mentioned that in the early part of the dot-com bubble, the basic discipline of business that growth is important, but so is profitability and so is unit economics. That discipline, somehow or the other, in the early part of this decade, again went away. Or in the last few years, it went away. It's starting to correct itself again. But what happens in the minds of venture capitalists that this, you know, what seems like basic arithmetic suddenly disappears?
Yes, okay, forgive me. I didn't follow the last few years. So if we talk much on the last few years in particular, we like to oversimplify by saying that venture capitalists have only two kind of glands. We have a greed gland and we have a fear gland. And we oscillate between the two. And so we get into these cycles where greed overtakes. I would say that was 1999, 2000, and again probably in 2007, and then again probably in 2013, 14, into part of 2015. By part of 2015, it started switching to fear. We had stock market nervousness, we have geopolitical threats around the world, very strange macroeconomic environment, unprecedented weird low rates for extended periods of time. So investment was driven down, a lot of strange behavior in the big markets, which had its percolating effects down into our markets. Now, one difference that I like to say is that the sport of an investment banker or someone who follows the public markets is like surfing. They're worried about waves and weather and sharks up on the surface, whereas an early stage VC and, of course, an entrepreneur starting a company should be more like a scuba diver, worried about long-term currents and don't hit the reef, you know, big, slower, longer-moving trends. So I try not to worry about the edgy, latest, trendy Wall Street happening. I worry more about what's the big new platform trend, what's happening in the networks of the future. How do algorithms affect traditional industries that may be disrupted? Those are the kind of things that I think people need to be looking for. And there again, the news is good for entrepreneurs. Just because you have a big established brand, thousands of branch offices, does not mean you're going to control that industry for the future decade. We've seen so many examples of disruption.
Let's talk about those key trends where you see good news for the entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. Well, a few of them are, I would say that there are a few big areas that are dramatically helpful for young entrepreneurs. I think, for example, things like the Internet of Things offers enormous opportunities because we take huge swaths of traditional industries that have been not touched very much by the internet economy, by the mobile economy, and we move both of those things together, connecting lots and lots of devices for increased efficiency that will need new algorithms, it will need new managerial dashboards, it will mean new supply chains, new cybersecurity improvements. A lot of opportunity here because things that were once unconnected become connected. So that's one area. Another, we don't invest a lot yet in this area, but we think that the area of synthetic biology is highly interesting, and new types of manufacturing, 3D printing, et cetera, very exciting. Our focus is mostly information technology, but even in information technology, a few things that specifically help young, new entrepreneurs, agile development. This is a breakthrough. The fact that we can do product cycles much faster, do short sprints of software development, means that we can test with the market very quickly through A/B tests and put things out in a minimal viable product. That was not really possible 15 years ago. Remember that 15 years ago, the model was sell big software to the CIO, the chief investment officer, or chief information officer. And they were generally like, we call them Dr. No. They were always saying no, and they didn't want to take a risk on a startup. Now it's flipped. Today they cannot not take a risk on a startup. They have to engage with startups. I just came back from Japan 2 weeks ago, and I met with the biggest companies, all the names you know. All of them said, we need innovation. We need Silicon Valley, we need Tel Aviv, we need Bangalore. We need innovation from entrepreneurs, especially in software, in these new fields, to bring life and dynamism to our existing brands, our existing factories, our existing networks. That to me is a sign of real progress, and I think it's not just in Japan, it's everywhere. We get delegations from all over the world saying, we're a giant company, we're global, we have a huge brand, we need to engage with startups, and we're willing to take more risk, we're willing to give more support, etc.
So what is your investment thesis, given the backdrop that we have discussed? As a venture capitalist, what kinds of things are you excited about, and what kind of things are you looking to invest in right now?
Sure. Again, because of the history buff, if I can go 300 years of economic history in 1 minute, I'll do it fast. In the 19th century, the great game changers, the huge opportunities were created by moving from animal and human power to machine power, mainly through the steam engine. So steamships and railroads and mining equipment and agriculture were transformed. In the 20th century, agriculture became extremely efficient compared to all prior human history by the use of tractors and combines and fertilizers and so on. Now, in the 21st century, we believe that the huge improvement will come in the area of the services economy and the information economy. And you might think those are different, but they're really tied together. Services and information tend to drive much of the world's GDP today, even in the developing countries. But more than half of the GDP in the world today comes from information services businesses. More than half of the world's people today live in urban settings. So the world is moving more and more in this direction. So the opportunity exists to make these large industries, such as financial services, logistics, entertainment, insurance, more and more efficient. Many of them operate by human underwriting in financial services, for example. And a lot of that can be done now better through algorithms. And we can distribute better than through branches in the center of a city, instead of that on mobile phones to people in rural villages or wherever they are in the workplace. So a lot of these phones, a lot of these businesses will dematerialize and become more in the cloud and service oriented. Take one more example, automobiles. I was at a conference speaking in Mexico recently, and it was about transportation of the future. And I'm not an expert in that, but I have some theories. And so the first lady from Ford Motor got up and she said, the future of transportation is green, recyclable, sustainable. And then a man from Delphi Auto Parts got up and he said, the future of the automobile is connected, Wi-Fi, GPS, Bluetooth. And I got up and I said, I don't know what the future of the automobile is, but I want to ask you, the audience. There were 1,000 people in Mexico in the audience. And I said, okay, choices A and B. Is it A, a product that you buy, you own, you fill with gas, you change the oil, when it crashes, you take it to the garage to fix, you park it, et cetera, et cetera, and it only comes in one shape and size during the lifetime of your ownership? Or answer B, is it a service? It comes to you when you call it, it comes as a motorcycle one day, a limousine the next day, a Ferrari, whatever you want to impress your date. And it's flexible, and you never fill the gas, you don't pay the insurance, it's all wrapped in a service. So A or B, 900 of those 1,000 people voted for the service. Yeah. And I see it with my nephews who are well-to-do engineers in Silicon Valley. And you know Silicon Valley, typically people need a car. He doesn't want a car. They don't want cars. They want Uber, they want Lyft, they want car sharing, they want alternative transportation systems that are more delivered as a service that's flexible. So what I'm saying is a lot of opportunity, but some of the changes are gargantuan. They're going to completely turn industries on their side. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. I think the transportation industry is probably at risk of being disrupted more than any others because the chain effect is so large, right? There is, you know, the behavior change of people not buying cars means that auto manufacturing goes bust, or become shrinks dramatically. Then the auto insurance busts or shrinks dramatically. The auto service busts shrinks dramatically. The drivers, I mean, this is like a 100 million jobs kind of impact.
Hold on. But you're talking about it in negative. Let me reframe through history. In 1776, when the United States became an independent republic from Britain, 95% of Americans worked in agriculture. Today, 2% of Americans work in agriculture, and yet we produce 20 times more food. It's more healthy, it's more GDP, we export to the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Our farmers are incredibly productive. Now, in the transportation industry, I would say we're very inefficient. One car driving me from my home to my office and sitting in the garage when I'm working and when I'm at home is extremely
inefficient. I don't have any disagreement with you on any of that. Yes. I think the fact, the larger trend, however, is that, you know, probably 80%, 60 to 80% of all jobs in the industry in the next 50 to 100 years are going to go away. And that is a very disruptive change. I've written extensively about this. I don't want this conversation to be about that. I'm more interested in this conversation. I'm actually more interested in what does this do and what opportunities does it open up for the entrepreneur? And, you know, correspondingly for people like you who are going to invest in these entrepreneurs. So so if you look at this, you know, grand scheme of things, clearly artificial intelligence is a driving trend that, and vertical cloud is a driving trend, or vertical AI is a driving trend in each of these segments that we talked about, we touched upon. There are immense opportunities for automation and thinking machines as, you know, as we see them gradually morphing into. So absolutely, that's, you know, that's one of the areas where entrepreneurs are going to create innovation and create growth. And the large companies are also not sitting and twiddling their thumbs. IBM's big bet is Watson. So absolutely, that's one key trend. Is there anything else that you're tracking? And everything we've discussed actually kind of falls in this general area, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and that clubs big data, that clubs IoT, that clubs vertical cloud, all of that into one. Is there any other major area that you're tracking where you see a lot of opportunities for entrepreneurs and building large companies, sizable companies, not just building little companies?
Yes. Well, let me give you one example where we've had incredible exits recently, and that's the area of cybersecurity. And it's actually, size is not on your side. In other words, the startup community has more of the new knowledge that's important, more of the value, more of the IP that's really sought after than the largest company. And we see this over and over. Our last acquisition was a company called Cyvera. This company was only 20 months old when it was sold for $200 million to Palo Alto Networks. They had almost no sales. They had a tiny staff, but they had incredible IP for endpoint security protection in a new form that protected against what are called advanced persistent threats and particularly zero-day threats. So this is an area where the large companies find that the product cycles are moving too fast for them to keep up. They need entrepreneurs desperately, but the entrepreneurs find it easier to develop in a startup environment than inside the fold of a large organization. So typically what we see is startup creative teams form, develop to a certain stage, and then yes, they do sell off and they don't always go public themselves, but they sell to a big market leader who has huge sales force and customer support and all that. But then guess what? Those entrepreneurs are not going off and retiring and living on an island in Tahiti and drinking margaritas. They go back and they start another company. And we see it over and over, the serial entrepreneur habit. So I think what's exciting, when I was in junior high school, I heard a very powerful futurist, and he talked about the fact that my parents had one job for their whole life, and how we would have many jobs in our lives. And it's so exciting because you can keep reinventing yourself and learning from the past experience, and not every startup is going to be a success. So my message to your young entrepreneurs is try things. And you're not going to succeed all the time. That's okay. Keep learning. Be perseverant. Keep trying. And you will succeed, you know, further along. Maybe it's going to come early in your life, like Mark Zuckerberg. Maybe it comes later in your life. That's all right. Just keep trying. And the journey is as great as the end result.
So one of the observations I have, and I actually was reading this last week's Economist expose on superstars. You know, the and being a history buff, you may have already read this, you would appreciate the cycle that they're talking about is that for, you know, every time there's a major technological revolution, there's been this very disruptive period of 20, 30 years when there's a tremendous amount of startup activity and experimentation and innovation. And then that period then settles into kind of an oligopoly. And right now we do have a bit of an oligopoly in tech, right? We have, you know, four or five companies that are kind of in very dominant incumbent positions that are very difficult to compete with. I mean, the amount of data that Facebook has accumulated and the amount of precision with which they're able to target ads is impossible to compete with. The only other people who have even a remote chance is Google because of their search and intent data capture. But if you look at the media industry, one after another, they're all going out of business. Just recently, I don't know if you follow this company, Mode Media, it had started life as being called Glam Media and had raised a lot of money with a unicorn company, multi-billion dollar valuation. And I knew the CEO very well. It's an experienced CEO, serial entrepreneur. But didn't work because the market has changed. You know, this company has been around almost 10 years. And today, I don't think a media company without that level of personalization somehow is going to make it. So there's a whole business model that is basically no longer viable for startups. Here, in 1 million by 1 million, any entrepreneur that comes to me and says, oh, I'm going to monetize with ads, I immediately tell them, no, you're not. This is not going to work because that is the dead end. So we are at a cycle in you know, information technology entrepreneurship where some significantly lucrative business models are going away. And the scenario that you describe of large companies not able to keep up with their R&D and looking to the startup hinterland, especially in Silicon Valley, to do the R&D that they then acquire and access, that is one model of startups. But how many exits happen in 1 year in the industry? That limits, because the number, the startup activity right now is very high, right? And the, I think it was 2013 or 14, I don't remember which year it was, but 70,000 companies got angel funded. That's a lot of companies. And I think it has actually gone down lately, but still there is worldwide, there's a tremendous number of startups constantly coming up, and there's just not going to be enough exits for all these companies, one. The other trend is the growth rates of these startups. So if you actually look at, if you don't get early exits, then you're going to have to build this company, you have to grow this company at a very fast pace to fit the venture capital model of continuous financing and you know, growing to sizable scale so that the company can have a public market exit. That path is becoming harder for a lot of companies because of the incumbent's role being so so extensive. So this is kind of like my observations. I'd like to hear what you are observing of, you know, all these pieces. How does this come together in your mind, putting the venture capitalist hat on?
Sure. Okay, I have three different points. Let me start with your last point first. One, the Chamber of Commerce of the United States reported, I think it was last year or early this year, that traditionally in America, the last 20, 30 years, we had about 400,000 new companies started of all types, some venture-backed, but only a minority of them, and we'd have 400,000 started and 300,000 died. We were a growing economy of startups. Since 2009, it's flipped. And we've had 400,000 continue to be created, but 470,000 die every year. That is a bad sign. Now, it's partly due to the recession that hopefully is now ending, but it's not just that. I think we are killing the goose that lays the golden egg of entrepreneurship with over-regulation. I see it particularly in California, where people are moving to Texas and Nevada and other places that are less regulated with lower taxes and so on. I see it in the general movement of population from the northeastern industrial states to the more free market southern states, the sunshine states supposedly, and we see it moving across to other countries that have lighter regulatory burdens. You know, when we started to see France legislate 35-hour work week, we saw people start to move out of France. You make London the sixth largest French city. Things like this.
Until Brexit.
Government regulation favors the big company. It's not a friend of the startups. That's one point. Second point is I want to take a little bit of an exception to your point about, I don't disagree about this punctuated equilibrium theory where you said the economist was saying a lot of tumult for 20 or 30 years, disruption, and then stasis of big oligopolies. There may be some truth to that, but I would remind us all of, think about Nokia's dominant position just, you know, a decade ago. Everyone thought that Nokia was the king of mobile telephony going forward. And they were going to expand into media, and they were going to expand into content creation, and a whole bunch of allied fields. And today they're gone, basically. I mean, they're there, but it's a figment of its last self. MySpace, before Facebook. Think of the dominant position of the Yellow Pages before Google. Yahoo was before Google. Remember, the big search engine before Google. All these things are disrupting.
This is not what you're describing is not contrary to the point they're making. I think the point they're making is that we've gone through a 30-year extensive and rich innovation phase and startup activity phase. It is, however, you know, the company that really disrupted Nokia is Apple. And to some extent, the Google Samsung world has, but that, that followed. It was Apple that really disrupted Nokia. And what is that? So anyway, but now I think sitting in 2016 and looking ahead, there is, it seems like there is a bit more of a, you know, too many superstars dominating and kind of playing monopolistic roles in their individual areas. Like Facebook doesn't really have a competitor right now. Google doesn't really have a competitor in search. And these are dominant industries. At least on the cell phone side, on the smartphone side, there's competition. It's an oligopoly, but there's still at least some competition. These two are monopolies. On the business software side, there's a lot more competition. There's Salesforce.com, there's Microsoft, there's Oracle, there's SAP, and they're all still trying to do things and acquire companies and stay relevant. And there is a lot of startup activity that has built up companies to some scale. They're actually on cloud and big data and so forth. There are solid 50, 75, 100, $200 million companies and some even larger like ServiceNow, Viva. These are sizable SaaS companies that have come up. So that side has better dynamics, I think, much more healthy dynamics. But these, you know, like the media industry that I talked about earlier, this is completely finished at some level because of Facebook's domination. And how does that scenario change?
I hear you, and I agree to a large extent, and it concerns me. And so we tend to invest much more in the B2B, the industrial, the algorithmic, the AI-driven thing, because we find it easier to sell to businesses. Our firm has a very successful CIO council, Chief Information Officer Council, and includes chief marketing officers and chief security officers. And we get these folks in a room, men and women, New York and San Francisco and other places around the world, four times a year. And they tell us what they're looking for. And we show them new things that they've never seen. And they're excited to see startups. They want, again, big companies today. The good news, again, for entrepreneurs is large companies are now wanting your help. They are soliciting innovation, and they know they can't do it themselves. They need to buy from you, they need to partner with you to distribute, or they need to acquire your whole company, all three, or invest in you. All three or four are good options, which we're not really easily done, say, even 15 years ago. That's one. Let's take a different industry, because I agree with you to a large extent in media, but a couple things. One, in terms of advertising, my sense is the millennial generation doesn't trust advertising much at all. And that whole market of advertising is going to have to change very significantly. We have a very interesting company called Yotpo in our portfolio, which is flipping advertising on its head because it uses customer reviews that are validated by social media profiles to show that it's a real customer who actually bought this product and actually has X, Y, and Z opinion about it. And I think people don't trust religion, they don't trust government, they don't trust businesses, but they trust their friends. And so when you see a friend telling you about the new tennis racket they bought and showing you, and I got a great serve with this and so on and so forth, you have much more incentive to go out and actually try it. So I think some of it is going to flip around, maybe to the benefit of Facebook, but maybe to some new other entrants. I don't know. But let's go to a totally different field. Let's go to the area of food. All right, this is more approachable. Many of your million entrepreneurs are not going to be in high tech and certainly not in Silicon Valley. But if you want to create a new kind of food brand, look at the proliferation from when Sharman or you and I were children. There was Coke and there was Pepsi and there was milk. I mean, there were, I don't know, kind of three kinds of drinks. And now if you go to the average service station for gasoline, you walk in and there's like 500 kinds of drinks to choose from. You know, all kinds of strange ones, fermented yogurt and different things and mango and blah, 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 blah. So all these were started by entrepreneurs. Very rarely were these new brands created by the Pepsi and the Coke. Pepsi and Coke buy these brands, that's fine, okay, but the entrepreneur has made money along the way. But it's because the consumer is getting tired of a monopoly offering. And I think, like that, consumers are going to get tired of Facebook. I do.
Well, this actually is an area, what you're talking about, of differentiated, you know, well-merchandised consumer products, new consumer products in existing categories or sometimes even new categories. This is a very interesting area because Facebook has actually created an unbelievable platform for entrepreneurs to hyper-target. And that hyper-targeting capability never existed until now.
Exactly.
It's amazing. For $20, the kind of hyper-targeting you can do, you know, maybe you're reaching for $20, you're reaching 5,000 people, but they're the 5,000 right people, and it's incredibly efficient. So there actually, there's some good news for the consumer entrepreneurs who are trying to build something. I think there's a good news, bad news in the story that you told, in that Amazon has locked up distribution and logistics in such a tight way that all the big categories are kind of locked up. However, the niche, the new merchandising, the new products, new brands are, that's where I think the e-commerce opportunity or the new branded consumer opportunity is.
Yes.
I know that's not where you invest, but.
No. You've invested, you just mentioned something where we did invest. We invested in the infrastructure for food manufacturers in a company called CaseStack. And they're now, they started in LA. Very interestingly, they moved to Bentonville, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And guess why? Because they wanted to be by Walmart. And now they build consolidation programs for logistics for Walmart, for Kroger, for I think they're starting to work with Amazon. Certainly they do with HEB and with some of the other big ones, Whole Foods, for example. And they help small entrepreneurs, say under $2 billion in revenue, that's small these days, and they help them be much more efficient in their logistics of what we call LTL, less than truckload, making it full truckload. And I won't bore you with the details, but essentially what they're moving to is a software solution that puts the entire supply chain for logistics management in the cloud. And it makes it end to end. I can sit in my office where I make hot chili pepper sauce in Waco, Texas, and I sell it all over the world, and I don't have to know anything about shipping and logistics and warehousing. All of it happens seamlessly, and I meet the extremely difficult demands of huge customers like Walmart or Amazon for their fulfillment. So that's, again, helping the entrepreneur. What I love is seeing companies that start to level the playing field. And let me give you another example from FinTech, financial services, where, again, people think, oh, it's all rigged in the benefit of the Goldman Sachs and their big wealthy client. We just invested in a company called EarnUp here in San Francisco. Two entrepreneurs who bootstrapped themselves into an MRR of, you know, tens of thousands of dollars before they even came to us. So they are helping average people who are in debt with a mortgage, a student loan, a car loan, a personal loan, to pay these things off in an automated fashion so that it optimizes the minimum interest payments and the maximum financial health for the consumer, for the borrower. We never miss a payment. We pay down extra principal whenever we have extra money available in our bank account. And this is a SaaS model, low-cost service, extremely easy to use, and it helps these average people, you know, you, me, average Joe, do better in the credit markets, build their credit score, never waste money with a missed payment, and always make sure that the bank credits the principal early payment instead of saying that, oh, this is just future interest. So this all benefits the consumer. And we're seeing, again, many companies like this to start to help average people level the playing field. Technology can benefit the elite and the big companies, but it can also help benefit the average person in ways that their great-grandparents would never have imagined possible.
Well, and I think the opportunity of selling B2B SaaS to small, medium enterprises is a massive one still. If the customer acquisition is a bit more complicated, but it's become a lot easier because of these targeting capabilities and hyper-targeting capabilities. It has become a lot easier even to acquire customers in that space. And that continues to be a very sizable opportunity still. That's not very heavily penetrated yet.
Totally agree with you. And another example from FinTech of a problem and then how we solve it. We often say that it's harder to find a good problem than a good solution. So you got to look for the problem. Right? Now, we had an entrepreneur who came into us with a company called Lendio. His name is Brock, he's from Utah, and he came into us, and after he finished his presentation, I said to him, Brock, we've been waiting for you. We knew that a company like this needed to be built. Thank goodness you came to us first and we could invest in you. So what does this company do? It's called Lendio, L-E-N-D-I-O. And they are a one-stop shop for borrowing for entrepreneurs, SMBs, small, medium-sized businesses. Now, say you wanted to get an equipment loan, or you wanted to get a mortgage for building a factory, or you wanted to get a general line of credit, or you wanted to factor some of your clothing sales. All those are different kinds of loans. They require you to go to different institutions, different account managers, different forms, different data. Forget that. Lendio takes one application with everything you need, and they then put a bid out to relevant lenders so that they compete for your business. It's a great model, growing really fast, and then they have on the other side of the marketplace people like OnDeck and Prosper and Sunbox, which is another one of our investments, that are bidding for your business as an entrepreneur. And here's the real problem. This is not talked about by politicians, but it's a real crisis for small business. In the United States, since the 2008 crash, and I think it's similar around the world in many countries, the lending to small businesses has decreased. Cash flow has really tightened up. The average day sales outstanding ratio, which is essentially your receivables, has gone from 45 days of cash flow in the United States to 90 days in the last decade. That is a crisis for small businesses, right? Terrible, and super hard for small businesses to carry a quarter of their annual inventory revenue or their turnover on their own credit. So they rely on credit cards, which are extremely expensive. So we've tried to help them with companies like Lendio. Fundbox does it in an automated way where you can clear your receipts right from Intuit as soon as you send out the invoice. Those are kind of things that are moving toward helping the SMB market, and I agree with you, it's easier to target them. You can reach them through email, through Facebook, through a variety of channels and partners that make it great for an entrepreneur today.
So I know we are kind of over time, actually, what we said we would take up of your time, but I do want to finish by having you talk to us a little bit about what stage do you invest in, and you've talked a lot about the segments and the preference with B2B, but you have done some B2C as well in fintech. But talk to us about stage as a concluding segment.
Sure. Sure. First, thanks for this great opportunity. You do a great service to entrepreneurs, really great service to the world, and I hope a lot of politicians are listening to you.
I wouldn't count on that.
I hear you. At Bloomberg Capital, we believe that there are many brilliant entrepreneurs all over the world, and we're open. We're based in Silicon Valley, but we have an office in New York, we have an office in Tel Aviv, and we've invested in companies all over the world. We're open to you wherever you come from. We can help you most in Silicon Valley with the networking and the ties here, so of course that's our strength, but that's probably something if you're going for a global market that's important to you anyway. Now, what we invest in is early stage. Seed and A is our specialty. A few $100,000 up to $5 million on our first check. That's our average would be $1 to $3 million. And we like to follow on with our investments. We are very active investors. We jump in, we'd like to go on the board of directors. We're particularly good, I think, at business development, helping you find leads, channel partners, helping you with recruiting, and especially helping you raise the next round. Because we know a lot of the big, famous, larger firms in Silicon Valley that do series A, B, and C, and we bring you to them kind of with white gloves. So the idea is to help the entrepreneur. And one last thing, we like to say that instead of the entrepreneur as the puppet and the VC as the marionette master, which is other people's metaphor, our metaphor is you, Mr. or Miss Entrepreneur, you drive the race car, you drive the Ferrari, we're your pit crew. We're here to change the tires, fill the gas, get fans into the stands, root for you, cheer for you, and because we've driven this track 16 times, we'll give you some advice on how not to crash around the corner. Go
and
for it.
When you are doing these B2B investments, especially seed investments or, you know, very early Series A investment, what kind of MRR or ARR are you looking for to see evidence that there is potentially something there?
The best story, best explanation is an example. So I'll give two. Our best two investments so far have been Nutanix, which according to the Wall Street Journal may be going public this month, right down by you in San Jose. Three brilliant engineers came to us with zero product, zero customers, just a great idea. We backed them because they were brilliant. They had a huge problem to solve. They showed us a clear technological path to do so. They were perseverant, driven, and today they're a world beater in hyperconverged infrastructure. Second one was a company called Hootsuite from Canada. And I met Ryan, the founder, at a conference in New York. It was the first Twitter conference ever held. And I saw that Twitter had been such a success. I thought, oh, other infrastructure companies around that will probably do well, and I particularly like the B2B angle. Now, he had 125,000 users, but they were not paying anything. It was all free. So we talked about the freemium model and moving people up and to the right in terms of give them more modules of value, charge them higher levels, start with SMBs, and then move into the large enterprises. It's, of course, exactly what they've done. They're now, again, a world beater in social media management. They have millions and millions of free users still, but of course all the revenue comes from SMBs and especially now large enterprises. So it's a great example. These are companies that had zero revenue, one had zero traction, one had significant traction but no revenue. Both of those equations are okay. And then I gave you the last example of EarnUp, which had about an MRR of, I think it was about 35,000, 40,000 for the year, sorry, 35,000 a month, and we thought that was great, especially that they'd taken no capital prior. So we're not so fixated on traction. It's easier to sell us if you have traction, of course, but if you don't have traction, we want to see evidence that somebody is going to buy. In the B2B area, it's easier to prove because we have a CIO council. We'll vet you with those people. We'll say to them, if our entrepreneur builds this, would you buy it? And that is a good enough answer for us if the answer is yes.
We have done the Nutanix case study, folks, so I would strongly encourage you to look up that case study. It's a great story and definitely worth learning about. We have covered Hootsuite extensively, but we haven't had Ryan at the Entrepreneur Journey series. So, David, I would like to actually invite Ryan to come and tell the Hootsuite story, you know, the full story of Entrepreneur Journeys. you know, the trend right now in the Valley is that people are looking for about an 80K MRR or $1 million ARR before they would do a Series A. I'm very pleased to hear that you're saying that you're doing real venture capital as opposed to, you know.
Well, for example, in cybersecurity, it's impossible to have that when we first invest. Most of the companies would be too big if they already have that kind of account. We go in earlier. Now, we have an advantage. I think our Israeli office finds the most amazing cybersecurity companies because of the special link that the intelligence units have there with the entrepreneurial community. But most of them have zero revenue when we invest, and we're not afraid of that at all.
Well, and also in cybersecurity, there are a lot of repeat entrepreneurs. This is a field ripe with serial entrepreneurs who have done it before and have track records. So I think those kinds of entrepreneurs are having an easier time raising money on concepts. The first-time entrepreneurs usually do not get to raise money on concepts.
Well, we still open the door to them, and we invest in a lot of first-time entrepreneurs. I think the majority of our, it's not that they haven't had jobs before, but they rarely have been CEO previously.
Very good. I'm thrilled to hear all the things that you have to say, and we'll find opportunities to work together. Thanks for coming, David.
I would love to. Thank you so much. Good luck.